We'll hear argument now in the case of Graham against Borden. Mr. Locher.
Good morning. May it please the court, Stephen Locher on behalf of the petitioner Richard Graham. This matter is a petition for writ of habeas corpus based on what we believe is a clear violation of Mr. Graham's Fifth Amendment protections against double jeopardy. There is really no dispute about the constitutional principles and Supreme Court precedent underlying this case. I think that respondent has conceded that if Mr. Graham was sentenced on and convicted to two crimes, his sentence would violate his Fifth Amendment protections. So the only questions really then are two. First, was he in fact convicted of and sentenced on two crimes? And second, they have raised a procedural objection. They have challenged the timeliness of this appeal. On the first question,
timeliness of the appeal?
The timeliness of our petition. The appeal is timely.
Yes. Okay.
The question is the timeliness of the petition. On the first question, the constitutional question, our position is that the record is clear. Mr. Graham clearly pled guilty to, was found guilty of, and was sentenced on two crimes.
I must say I don't see why the answer matters, given Missouri against Hunter, Ohio against Johnson, and McLeod against Depesh.
Those cases, Your Honor, deal with the question of what the intent of the state legislature was.
No, they don't. There are two separate questions. What the intent of the state legislature is a question of state law, and we can't review that on collateral attack, as McLeod held in a straightforward way. We have to assume, when the case comes to federal court, that what happened is what the state wanted to happen. The only question is whether the federal constitution allows that to happen. And the clear holding of Hunter and Johnson and McLeod is that the federal constitution allows consecutive sentences for greater and lesser offenses if they're imposed in a single proceeding, that is, if there's only one jeopardy.
Except that...
So I don't see what's left.
The Wisconsin legislature does not allow consecutive sentences.
That's a question of state law. We have to assume, when the case is here, that whatever happened to your client, the state allows to happen.
But the basis of the state court's decision in this case was not that the Wisconsin legislature has allowed consecutive penalties for the lesser included and greater offenses. The basis of the state court's conclusion was that there was only one sentence and only one conviction.
You contend that that's wrong as a matter of fact, that there are two sentences. And let's suppose that's right. The federal question is whether the federal constitution allows the state to do that.
Right.
And is there any doubt from the holding of Missouri against Hunter that the federal constitution allows that to happen?
If the state legislature has also said that it is allowed to happen.
That's
the federal
question. Look, that's a question of state law. We cannot grant relief on a premise that there was a violation of state law in a judgment of a state court.
Right, but in State versus Gordon, the Wisconsin Supreme Court said, we do not think the legislature intended to allow lesser included and greater offenses to be sentenced consecutively.
Well, isn't the question whether or not the legislature specifically authorized cumulative punishment?
That's right, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court concluded that it did not. So, Judge Easterbrook, getting back to your question about the federal constitutional issue, that federal constitutional issue depends on state law. And the state law here is clear. The Wisconsin legislature has said, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has said, the state legislature did not intend for consecutive penalties on the lesser included and greater offenses of felony murder. I think the state, the respondent, I should say, has actually conceded that point. I don't mean to put words in her mouth.
The state does not appear to have read these decisions accurately.
Well, in any event, I think they have, and I think we have as well. This might be the only time that I agree with respondent, but I think the Wisconsin Supreme Court has clearly held that.
Let me ask the question this way. We cannot issue a writ unless some rule is clearly established. What case of the Supreme Court would you cite for the proposition that it is clearly established that consecutive sentences that result from a single proceeding violate the Double Jeopardy Clause? Any case where the Supreme Court has held that?
I think What we're really talking about is...
No, I'm asking for a case. What is your best case for that proposition?
North Carolina versus Pearson, Brown versus Ohio.
They involve two proceedings.
That's right.
Just listen to my question. What is the case where the Supreme Court has clearly established, that consecutive sentences imposed in a single proceeding, one jeopardy, violate the Double Jeopardy Clause?
There isn't one, but what we're getting to here
Indeed
is whether...
There is none.
But for purposes of writ of habeas corpus, if the state has made an unreasonable application of existing Supreme Court precedent into a new area, then we're also entitled to the writ, and that's the situation that we have here. It would be unreasonable for the state to say, even though the legislature has not authorized consecutive penalties for the lesser included and greater offenses, we are still going to impose one. That was actually part of the McLeod versus Debitch opinion. They said this case would be different. This court said this case would be different if the Wisconsin legislature had said no consecutive penalties, but the Wisconsin court had said, yes, we will impose consecutive penalties anyway.
Yes, we said it would be different as a matter of state law, and that we lack the authority to issue writs based on violations of state law.
I read the opinion to mean it would be different from a federal constitutional perspective for purposes of habeas corpus.
Do you think we ought to go on to Balsawitz versus Kingston?
I'd be happy to. That case is very similar to two or three Wisconsin Court of Appeals cases that we cited in our brief. The issue there is whether Section 974.06, which is the basis for Mr. Graham's appeal in the state court, whether that is a direct review or a collateral review statute. And in State versus Balsawitz, there was a suggestion that 974.06 is collateral review. However, the defendant in that case, the petitioner in that case, had already taken an appeal from his conviction. That's not the situation here. Until Mr. Graham filed his 974.06 motion, he had never taken an appeal from his conviction. And that distinction was very important to the Wisconsin Supreme Court in State versus Escalon and Naranjo.
See, I'm having some problem with that because Graham still had but 1 year from the date of his state court judgment to file his habeas claim. And that was a deadline that was long past.
I don't think the deadline was long past, Your Honor. The 1 year statute of limitations starts to run. The one-year statute of limitations runs by reference to state law. Whenever the time for seeking direct review of the state proceeding expires, that's when the one-year period starts to run. Our position, based on 974.06's plain language, is that the time for him seeking direct review never expired, because that's what 974.06 says. The time for seeking review under this provision shall not expire. And so in that respect, our motion here, his motion to the trial court, was timely. And since he had never appealed that previously, his appeal from that motion was direct review of his conviction. That's the effect of State versus Escalon and Naranjo, and it's also the effect of State versus Bryce, which is a different Wisconsin Supreme Court case interpreting Section 974.06. Getting back to the substance, if I could, actually, I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Certainly, Mr. Walker. Ms. Tripp.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Kate Lloyd Tripp, and I represent the respondent. It's the state's position that this court should not reach Graham's double jeopardy claim because his habeas petition is untimely. Should this court decide to examine Graham's claim anyway, the state contends that it's without merit. Turning to the question of timeliness, Graham was convicted and sentenced in 1991, and he did not file a direct appeal. Allowing for the one-year grace period given to prisoners convicted before the effective date of the AEDPA, Graham's habeas petition, in order to be timely filed, needed to be filed in the district court by April 24, 1997. It was not filed until June 2004, more than 7 years late. Graham contends that the period of limitations did not begin to run for purposes of 2244D until after the Wisconsin Supreme Court denied the petition for review from his 974.06 motion. This position is incorrect. Graham's basis for this contention is that 97406 is equivalent to direct review, and this illustrates his misunderstanding of Wisconsin post-conviction law. 97406 allows for a defendant...
Is this, by the way, a question of state law or of federal law? How to characterize a state proceeding for federal timeliness purposes, one would suppose, a question of federal law, is it not? Suppose a state says, oh, to take a random example, New Jersey. Suppose New Jersey says, we've abolished the distinction between direct and collateral review here in New Jersey. We allow direct review, but we allow it repeatedly. Would that mean that the federal time limit for collateral attacks in New Jersey had just been abolished because direct review could be had 15 years after the conviction?
No, I don't think so. I think that the Third Circuit could apply the AEDPA, determine under 2244 what Congress meant by the expiration of direct review to the particular state's post-conviction procedures. And as this court said in Page, 97406 is Wisconsin's collateral review statute, and as the Wisconsin statute itself says, it's available to a prisoner to seek review, quote, after the time for appeal has expired. And as this court recently stated in Balsawitz, when faced with a somewhat similar argument, to find otherwise would render the AEDPA's time limits meaningless. Okay, so although we contend that the petition is untimely, if this court chooses to reach the merits of Graham's claim, we submit that the claim is without merit.
You know, the petitioner accused you in the briefs of ignoring two pieces of evidence that demonstrate that he was given consecutive sentences. In particular, the guilty plea questionnaire and the colloquy from the plea hearing, in which the judge states that he is sentencing Graham to 20 years on the felony murder and 10 years on the attempted armed robbery. So what should we make of that evidence?
Well, first, with regard to the plea questionnaire, I think that the plea questionnaire is not a charging document. So while it might be relevant, I don't think it's dispositive. And normally in a felony murder guilty plea in Wisconsin, you see, you know, the crime pled to felony murder followed by a parenthetical of whatever the underlying felony is. So in this case, attempted armed robbery. But here it said felony murder, comma, attempted armed robbery. I don't think that this is anything more than maybe an improper way to fill out the plea questionnaire. It doesn't change what Graham was charged with, which was just felony murder in both the complaint and the information. So I don't see how he could plead to more than one crime since he was charged with only one crime. And turning to the plea colloquy as well as the sentencing hearing, we do concede that there was some confusion in the language and some muddling of whether or not it was one crime or two crimes. But again, he was charged with, just charged with one crime. So there are points in the plea colloquy where the judge says you're pleading to this charge, this charge, this charge, implying one charge, and then yes, at the end he says these charges, felony murder and attempted armed robbery. But I still don't think that that changes this to a double jeopardy violation. I think Graham may have had a more successful claim had he attacked the knowingness of his plea or the effectiveness of his counsel, but I don't think that he can show a double jeopardy violation, and I think that the Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision finding that this was ultimately some language confusion and maybe a clerical error is a factual determination.
See, it doesn't it look unseemly, let us say, that in response to Graham's claim of double jeopardy, the state court simply went back and corrected the judgment of conviction to reflect that Graham was sentenced to only one offense? I mean,
I can see a case where that would make me uncomfortable, but this simply isn't it. I mean, given that he was charged with just one crime, I don't think he could be convicted of more than one crime. I think that the trial court, as well as the parties, certainly could have clarified this issue and spoken more eloquently on the topic, but I still don't think that their failure to do so amounts to a double jeopardy violation. And unless there are any further questions, I just ask that you deny Graham habeas relief.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further?
Two very quick points, may it please the court. First, a person can be convicted of any crime for which there are sufficient facts set out in the criminal information. So the question of whether there was one crime listed or two is really irrelevant. The real question is what happened at the sentencing hearing, what happened at the guilty plea hearing, and I think our briefs pretty well establish that. Second, under 974.06, subsection 2 says, and I quote, I'm going to paraphrase it first. A motion for relief under this section, quote, is a part of the original criminal action, is not a separate proceeding, and may be made at any time. That is the provision that we believe makes 974.06 a direct review statute, and that is why we believe the Wisconsin Supreme Court in Escalona-Naranjo took the position that 974.06 should be treated like a direct review statute. So our petition is timely. It was direct review because Mr. Graham had never taken a previous appeal, and it is not inconsistent with the Balsowitz case that you cited earlier because the defendant in that case had taken a previous appeal. That's a very important distinction, and it was very important to the Wisconsin Supreme Court in Escalona-Naranjo.
Is it your view, by the way, that direct review was pending all of those 13 years? I mean, suppose a petition for collateral review had been filed in federal court in 1999. What would have happened?
Before a 974.06 motion, or?
Mm-hmm. In 1999, everything else the same.
I think it would be the same result. I think it would still be direct review because it was his first appeal from his conviction, and because the language...
Look, he filed that request sometime after 1999. I'm asking what would have happened had the federal petition been filed in 1999.
Would have been premature because he hadn't exhausted his state law
would have been
options.
Premature?
That's right, because he wouldn't have exhausted all of his state law avenues for relief at that point in time. If there are no further questions,
mm-hmm.
My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Locher, we appreciate you and your firm's willingness to take the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been to your client and the court. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.